This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
If you're a sports fan, this has to be a great time of year for you. First of all, the Olympics are everywhere. Then there's the baseball pennant races, college and pro football getting underway. Student athletes of all ages, from Pee Wee to Division I, will be doing their best to be their best on the field. But for athletes of any age or experience level, that sometimes means taking performance-enhancing drugs. Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll look back at a unique debate of sorts we had a while ago on testing for PEDs. We'll hear from one doctor who says the system of drug testing is working just fine, and another who says scrap it and let them eat steroids.
I don't think that clinical chemistry laboratories are the best place to enforce an idea like fairness.
Then we'll spend an academic minute making money from the Olympics. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. As long as drugs exist that will enhance performance on the playing field and sports stars make millions of dollars, there will be doping in all athletic competition. The issue of sports doping in professional, college, the Olympics, even high school sports has gotten widespread attention over the past few decades, and the public seems to be continually reminded of athletes who cheat and the potential growing problem of doping at all ages. The major argument for anti-doping programs is that it levels the playing field, but it could be argued that that could also be achieved by removing all bans for all athletes. We're going to talk about both approaches today. First, with Dr. Larry Bowers, the Chief Scientific Officer of the United States Anti-Doping Agency in Colorado Springs. He has dedicated much of his career to anti-doping and has been asked many times why not just let everybody use whatever drugs and methods they want and then the playing field will be level. He talks about the first major flaw in this argument.
Well, the biggest flaw with that question is the assumption that it would somehow level the playing field. Just as an example, if two people have natural hematocrits of 42% and 48%, and you allow both of them to increase their hematocrit to 52%, the person with the 42% hematocrit gets much more benefit than the other person does. So pharmacological anarchy doesn't level the playing field, it just changes it. And it changes it in a potentially dangerous way. For example, an athlete could be coerced into what essentially would be an unregulated human experiment. To make this point even clearer, there's a great article in the July 1977 issue of Clinical Chemistry about the use of anabolic steroids in the East German women. And the long-term health effects of that have been documented in a number of television and other events.
Many people claim that testing is ineffective because the percentage of positive tests is very small. Why is testing still important?
Well, most people who count positive tests have the mindset that an anti-doping program consists only of testing. The real role of an anti-doping program is to prevent individuals from making the decision to dope in the first place. Testing is and will continue to be an important component of the program because it represents a potential cost for violating the rules. But the program also needs to provide education on the health risks of doping, and a good program also incorporates information gathered about doping practices in order to strategically use its resources. So testing is important, it's just not the only thing.
Deterrence has become a relatively new area of focus for USADA. What role do you think the deterrence model will play in the future of anti-doping?
Well, the goal in any anti-doping program, as I said, is to achieve compliance with the rules. And the athletes themselves have an important role in that process. The athletes need to develop an active community that supports clean sport. That's why the USADA investigation into cycling was so important. It gives cycling the opportunity to change the culture and to embrace clean sport. We'll see if that happens. But it can be done. The change in attitude among baseball players and their support in enacting tougher anti-doping rules in the aftermath of the Biogenesis scandal is a good example of how athletes can be part of the solution. For those athletes who are tempted to use performance-enhancing substances, the perceptual deterrence model provides a useful framework for developing an anti-doping program. Perceptual deterrence assumes that the decision to dope is a rational choice based on the rewards and costs. The three biggest factors that impact the cost are the perceived certainty of being caught, the perceived severity of the sanction, and the perceived celerity or timeliness of the sanction. Certainty, severity, celerity all need to be incorporated into the program. We don't have time here to delve into all of these, but let me give you a couple of examples. There are two types of sanctions. Formal sanctions, which are, for example, the loss of eligibility to participate imposed by the sport governance structure, and informal sanctions, which can be disapproval expressed by family, friends, teammates, and significant others. Interestingly, research shows that the informal sanctions can be viewed as more costly than the formal sanctions. An anti-doping program needs to make the athlete aware of all of the costs of doping in its application of the perceptual deterrence model. There are also a number of things that can be done to impact an athlete's perception that they could be caught. One of the most important is the possibility to be tested at any time without notice. In the USADA program, about two-thirds of our testing is carried out with no notice, as opposed to that at a competition.
USADA is a founding member of the Partnership for Clean Competition, which helps to fund independent scientific research. Why is research important in deterrence?
The perceived certainty of being caught is the most important of the three factors that I just discussed about the cost of breaking the rules. We have to ensure that people who violate the rules can be caught. There are new pharmaceutical substances being produced every day that have great benefit to people with illnesses, but that also have the potential for misuse. The anti-doping community is working with the pharmaceutical industry to develop tests for these substances before they're approved for human use. This cooperation is a large step forward for anti-doping. Also, people change their perceptions over time based on their experience within the system. In the case of doping, athletes and their unethical advisors change the routes of administration and dosages in order to avoid detection. So research into more sensitive methods and innovative approaches to detection is an important contributor to the continuing deterrence.
Well, finally, Dr. Bowers, what other kinds of innovative approaches are being implemented in anti-doping testing?
One of the relatively recent additions to the anti-doping field has been the use of investigations. The first sanctions given that were not based on a laboratory test result, but rather on documentation of rule violations, arose out of the Balco scandal in 2003. Tips, substantial assistance, and information from law enforcement have all been used not only to sanction athletes, but also to target our testing. We've also been storing athlete urine samples for up to 8 years. When new technology for detection of substances or methods becomes available, we can retest the samples using the new test. This increases athlete uncertainty about their ability to beat the test and thus increases deterrence. I mentioned the use of intra-individual reference ranges for monitoring hematological parameters and urinary steroid profiles. Being able to predict, for example, what the testosterone to epitestosterone ratio should be based on that individual's previous results has been very effective in applying other analytical technology, in scheduling additional sample collections, and improving anti-doping rule violations. We are actively working on incorporating alternate biological samples, such as oral fluid and dried blood and plasma spots, into our testing menus. Alternative samples promise to provide less expensive and less invasive collections that should translate into more testing. These scientific advances must be incorporated into prevention strategies in order to maximize their impact. Anti-doping programs will continue to require innovative, interdisciplinary approaches in order to be successful.
Dr. Larry Bowers is the Chief Science Officer of the United States Anti-Doping Agency, USADA, in Colorado Springs. Still to come, we'll hear another point of view about doping in sports. Essentially, anything goes. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and we're talking today about performance-enhancing drugs in sports, scholastic, Olympic, and otherwise. And for another take on the issue, we turn to Dr. Jeffrey Baird. He's the laboratory medical director of Northwest Hospital in Seattle, Washington, associate professor of laboratory medicine at the University of Washington, and director of clinical chemistry at Harborview Medical Center in Seattle. He also wrote an article in the journal Clinical Chemistry that, in essence, throws up its hands and says, "Bring on the PEDs and let's see what happens." I asked Dr. Baird what brought this on. Is he saying we should just scrap all drug testing in sports?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think the genesis of all of this is that at my heart, I am just a heartbroken sports fan. And that's where all of this started. I, as a kid, was very interested in sports. I collected baseball cards, followed all the baseball players, was interested in cycling, followed the Tour de France every year when it happened, always made sure I watched the end of it on, you know, on Bastille Day. And then, as I grew up, what I've learned was that almost all of my heroes in sports were frauds. And it just became very upsetting to me. And then as I got into the field of clinical chemistry, my first experiences were working in drug testing labs, and I learned a little bit more about the practice of all of this, and I just didn't understand the disconnect between, you know, what people thought was being shown by drug testing labs and what was actually happening. I think that what has upset me the most is that folks in the public have seen what we're doing in clinical chemistry labs as confirmation that everything is just fine because such an overwhelming majority of athletes pass all of these tests, yet it seems that so many of the folks in sports are actually doing these things that they shouldn't be doing. So that's why I wrote the article. I was upset with our role in this, and I came to believe that I think in clinical chemistry we might be lending something of a sort of a stamp of approval to some types of sports where it, certainly there doesn't seem to be any stamp of approval that is warranted. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be doing testing, but I think it's something that we need to talk about as a society, whether or not a clinical chemistry lab is the best method to enhance fairness. So that's what the article is about.
Well, let's talk about it some more. What do you think are the major shortcomings of anti-doping testing as it's practiced today?
I think one of the major shortcomings is using a test that doesn't have extremely high sensitivity or specificity is doomed to give you either false negatives or false positives, depending on the which situation you're looking at. And that is the situation here. It's my understanding, and that I believe this to be true, that one of the biggest fears in the anti-doping community is falsely accusing someone of doping. And so the tests are set to be very, very highly specific, and you must lose sensitivity if you gain in specificity. And so what we end up doing is letting a lot of people get off scot-free. So we have a lot of false negatives. Add in the fact there that people actively evade this, and that there are clinical chemists much smarter than I am who are working for the athletes who are doping. It really just seems that it's futile in many ways. And another one is that, simply put, it's just simply not working, and we have evidence of that. Lance Armstrong is one of the key examples of that. We saw him over and over and over again deny ever doing anything wrong. He was a hero. And then what happened? Well, he ended up admitting to what everyone sort of expected, is that he'd been doing it all along. And so we have a lot of evidence that it's just not working.
Or there must be some positive aspects to anti-doping testing. What about those?
Well, I do think there are some, and I would agree with the folks who are doing the anti-doping testing that some of the things that they say are true. So, for one thing, I do think that it to some degree levels the playing field. I think that there are some people who don't do this, who don't dope, simply because there's a deterrent effect. However, I do not think the deterrent effect is that strong. There is some indication of what the overall rate of doping is. I don't know what it is across all sports, but it's higher among some sports than others. But maybe it's not the majority of athletes, which may mean that actually the anti-doping testing is working as a deterrent. However, I would wonder if the overall rate of people using performance-enhancing substances, which may be a small minority, is the same if you look at the people who consistently win in activities. maybe in some there's some evidence in cycling anyways that the rates of doping in those who actually win their activities may be very, very, very high. Anecdotally from friends of mine who've been in competitive cycling and running and weightlifting, I'm led to believe that essentially everyone who wins some of these sports are doping. So it's not entirely a great thing, but there may be some deterrent effect, and there may be some aspect of ensuring that it is fair. But I don't think it has the complete effect that we might hope for. And my question is if we don't have a complete effect, then what are we really doing? Because the folks who are clearly, as in Lance Armstrong's case, the folks who are doing all of this performance-enhancing substance use, they're the ones who are winning still, and they're the ones who are getting the sports contract, and they're the ones who are, you know, showing up as heroes for our children, etc. So I'm not sure if having a little bit of success is really enough, and so that's one of the reasons why I question, should we be doing it at all?
Well, it seems pretty obvious that you personally feel that anti-doping testing is futile. What if we stopped? What if we stopped doing the testing? What kind of message does that send to athletes and fans and kids who aspire to be athletes?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I live in a state that recently, the Washington state, that recently legalized the recreational use of marijuana, and so in Colorado that also happened. And one of the questions that was risen at that time was, well, is that message we're now sending to our children that it's all okay and drug use is just fine? And I think the experience so far in Washington and Colorado has been that the sky has not fallen, and that it hasn't really been a large open season on drug use with people going and smoking marijuana everywhere. So I definitely think that if we just stop doing the testing, I think that the athletes and fans would get several explicit messages. One, to the athletes, I think they would have to see that the society has definitely made a decision about how we feel about this, and that it would certainly not be any sense of permission or congratulations for doing this, but I think more of an indictment of the practice. I think once it was clear that we'd sort of given up on this, which I think is what I'm indicating, then that's about as strong an indictment as we can give. And I think it would be up to the athletes to prove to us as a society that they are worthy of our adulation and our attention, etc. And as far as the fans, what would it mean? I can't say. I do know that certain times, say in horse racing, in competitive horse racing, they actually do list some of the drugs, like, for example, furosemide, Lasix. When a horse is taking that for a race, they just list it on the daily racing program, and people just take that into account and then make their bets or, you know, derive their enjoyment from the race knowing that information. And it doesn't seem to keep people away from the horse racing track at all. Now, maybe it's a bit cynical to think of human athletes as horses, but that's a bit how it's gotten, you know, in terms of the Olympics and, you know, in terms of a foot race. And I think people would simply just change the way that they thought about those sorts of events. Maybe someone wouldn't be as interested in spending $1,000 on a ticket to an NBA final or a Super Bowl or something like that, once they knew that everyone out there was, you know, essentially an expression of pharmacology rather than physiology.
Boy, if you listed everything Barry Bonds takes, his baseball card wouldn't be big enough.
Yes, another reason why I felt this way is honestly in specific Barry Bonds. I remember very explicitly when I was a child trading baseball cards, and one of my friend's favorite baseball players was Barry Bonds, and he had tons of used to collect his rookie card. And Barry Bonds, like Mark McGwire, was this tall, skinny guy. And then as he got better and better, you saw him get to the point where his neck was bigger around than my leg. And something fishy had to be going on there, and it became pretty obvious what was going on.
There are those out there who say that anti-doping testing has kept our sports fair and our athletes safe. What would you say to them?
What I would say to them is I would say somewhat, because that is true. I would bet you that there is somewhere out there who, you know, feels some deterrence. There are probably people out there for whom the Americans, you know, the entire government's anti-drug policy has kept them from using drugs, too, simply because it's wrong. Deterrent policies are somewhat effective, but the question we have to ask ourselves, is that enough? Is having a policy that keeps some people from doing it, but still allows a small group who end up being the ones who mostly succeed. Is that a fair policy? I don't think that that's fair. And so I would say that keeping things a little bit fair or a little bit safe isn't the same as keeping them entirely fair and entirely safe. What I'm suggesting might actually make things, say, less safe if more people did performance-enhancing drugs. But, you know, as I said, maybe people are already doing it so much that it's already not terribly safe and it wouldn't get any less safe. I don't think that clinical chemistry laboratories are the best place to enforce an idea like fairness. I think our social studies classrooms, I think that our public forums, our newspapers, et cetera, that's where we should be thinking about fairness, as opposed to artificially putting on some label of precision with a laboratory test result that really doesn't get at what is at the intrinsic sort of core of what fairness really is.
Dr. Jeffrey Baird is Laboratory Medical Director of Northwest Hospital in Seattle, Washington. You can read both Dr. Baird and Dr. Bauer's articles on doping in sports in the October 2014 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. I'm sure you've noticed that in addition to national pride, there's an awful lot of money at stake at the Olympics. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Is commercialism affecting the spirit of the Olympic Games? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Heather Reed, professor and scholar of the philosophy of sport at Morningside College, discusses this issue.
One major change in the Olympic movement of the new millennium is the demise of amateurism and the rising acceptance of commercialism. On the one hand, this change has improved the visibility and economic viability of the Games. On the other hand, it feels as though something important has been lost and a corporate paradigm is taking over with little opposition. It is sometimes forgotten that ancient Greek athletes were often highly paid and not at all averse to receiving lucrative prizes. But the Olympic Games prize of an olive crown was more valuable to them precisely because it lacked monetary value and therefore symbolized a higher, more divine calling than the practical need to earn a living. For the first century of the modern Olympic Games, there was an attempt to express this spirit through the idea of amateurism. However, in practice, amateurism became a way of excluding poorer athletes and inaugurating a shadow competition among individuals and nations in bending the rules to gain an advantage. The removal of amateur restrictions and inclusion of professional athletes, along with support programs like Olympic Solidarity, seem to have helped the cause of diversity. In fact, the wealthy professional athletes who compete in the Olympics today may best represent the ideal of competing for the love of sport rather than some expected practical reward. Capitalism seems more democratic, and therefore more Olympic, than the traditional social hierarchies familiar to the founders. The Games' arrival in China and now Brazil may be evidence of that. But capitalism also tends to concentrate and maintain wealth in the hands of a few, reducing the possibility for the have-nots of the world to compete with the haves. Corporate sponsorship can actually promote Olympic values, but can also exacerbate the problem of economic disparity, as when BMW develops bobsled technology exclusively for the American team, leaving even their home country sleds behind. In the future, I hope we may find a way to revive the spirit that underpinned amateurism, to embrace standards of value beyond the monetary, without losing the benefits of commercial support for the Games.
That was Heather Reed of Morningside College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.